Everybody have a handout? Okay, I think there's still some floating around. I'm going to open this with a 4 or 5 minute video, and then we're going to go in through the things of the outline, if you would please.
Option is to hide in the safest place that you can possibly find. And your last option is to fight.
You should always be aware of your surroundings when you enter public spaces. Know where to run or hide when there's an active shooter.
In many cases, the way you react will ensure your survival, and you need to use the crucial minutes before police arrive to safeguard yourself and your group.
Your first option, run. If you can escape without the shooter seeing you, then get out safely.
You should get as far away as possible and then call 911.
Be certain to tell them where you are and where the shooter is. Tell them what you saw. Describe the shooter, especially their clothes, the type of weapon, how many shots you heard, if there are any injuries, and give them your callback number.
You may have to get creative and go out a window. Remember to remain calm and quiet. Leave everything behind, including the injured. Help will be there soon. Keep in mind you have to be decisive. Commit instantly to a course of action and stick with it.
When danger becomes apparent, like you hear gunshots or see a shooter, your second option is to hide.
Don't expect the shooter to spend a lot of time searching. You have no idea what their motives are. Turn off the lights, lock the door, bar the door, and crouch behind anything large.
Don't make a sound. Put obstacles between you and the danger. Spread out. Don't create an easy target. Don't be lured out by the shooter. Make sure you wait for the all clear. And remember, you have seconds to act.
It will be disorienting and frightening, but having the presence of mind to react quickly can mean your survival. Keep your phones silent and out of sight. The screen will illuminate your face. Keep absolutely silent. The extra time it takes to force a door open or find someone means that the shooter will move on. The more difficult it is for the shooter, the better off you are. You've hidden from the danger.
The most difficult option you have is to fight. Research shows that groups that commit to fighting save lives. Remember, fight as if your life depends on it. Keep in mind the shooter carries a powerful weapon that has left bodies in its wake. He is not expecting to defend himself. Your attack will shock him and gain you precious seconds.
You can improvise weapons. Throw anything at the shooter. The bigger, the better. You can throw a book or a backpack, a fire extinguisher or a chair.
You can even hurl a desk or a computer at them. They are not expecting a fight. Rush the shooter as a large group, yelling and screaming. Statistics show that active shooters are apprehended within 5 minutes. In some instances, they are stopped by their intended victims. Police are just seconds away, and they are looking for the active shooter only. Let them know where he is, if you can.
Keep your hands up and fingers spread. Do not approach police. Stay quiet unless you are asked something, and avoid any sudden movements.
Don't ask for help, and once you are safe, leave with your hands up. Their first priority is finding the shooter. Let them do that. You can evacuate once safe in the same direction the officers took.
The unprepared react to danger with paralysis. They want to run, they want to hide, they want to fight, but they're unable to do so. That's why we emphasize preparation for these three simple options in an active shooter situation.
Facing an active shooter is unlikely, but it's important to be prepared. Note your surroundings as you walk around campus and know where the exits are. You should always have two in mind. That way you know where to run.
You should vary your routines across campus and be familiar with how to escape. Also, take note of places to hide. And most importantly, steel yourself for the fight of your life. The most important seconds of your life are in your hands.
Always be aware of how you will run, hide, and fight.
Okay. Cut. That's at the one end of the spectrum of the subject, and I wanted just to make sure that I presented at least those basics of run, hide, and fight, because that is kind of the mantra, if you will, when it comes to security things. That was done, obviously, at a college campus, but I thought that that would be something that would be close and applicable to where we are when we talk about churches. But just to kind of pose the question for you, if I will, I'm going to ask you to do something a little bit unusual, but I'm still by way of introduction here. I'd like everybody to close their eyes. Okay? I'm going to ask you a question. With your eyes closed, if you had to leave the sanctuary in a hurry, what would be your ways out of here? Okay. And? Windows and? Doors that you came in. Okay, you can open your eyes. My point is, and one of the things the young lady said in there in the video, there's a term that's used, situational awareness. And situational awareness is not so much that we are over-anticipating whether terrible things are going to happen, but just a habit that can be developed where, okay, if I need this, you know, when I walk into a fast food place, you know, I may want to look around there. In a church setting, people probably never even think about looking at exits or anything like that whatsoever. And yet, those are the things that if you had to escape here for whatever reason, and it's not just an active shooter, as I said, that's at the far end of the spectrum of what I'm going to cover here today. The outline that I've handed out to you is an idea of where to begin, because that always seems to be the problem when we talk about security. Where do you get started? What do you do first? What are the initial steps that are going to be taken? And so I've given to you then some of the things of the priorities that are there and some of the problems. I'll just briefly touch on those, because obviously the children are a target, so we want to make sure that our children are protected. And the question is then, what have we done to secure them? Do we have check-in, check-out systems? Is there access to where children's ministries are going on that whereby it is accessible from the outside of the building? Are there times when children are moving from place to place? And so does that expose them in any way? If they're going from a building to a building, is that an opportunity for somebody to try to do something malicious there? And to begin to think of it, and of course the priorities are for the children, but they're actually for all of our people, for our church members, for our personnel, for the people who are in the offices, the people who are here through the weeks and so forth and so on. And of course I trust that you're already involved in screening of your people, and that is something that needs to be actively undertaken. And I'll make one other comment on screening. Sometimes screening can have negative effects. There have been instances that I've been involved with where we found out some history of people in our church family, not that they were the perpetrators, but they were the victims in their past. And the whole business of going through that background check can evoke some of those things that happened where people were on the victim end of the problem. It's not just the perpetrators, but you have to also think about the fact that there are people, you may bring back some ugly history that they have been burying for 50 years. And so that's something to be sensitive to, because that can be very traumatic to those people if you have anybody who's been a victim, either as a child or young person or whatever the situation may be in the home. But I broaden the outline here because there are other more basic things. Just about how we do business. What happens if we lose electricity? I would think that everybody has had that experience somewhere, sometime, and okay, everything. And so what doesn't function then when you lose that? When we have severe storms, I don't know if you face hurricanes, tornadoes, you know, whatever it may well be. And what is your plan of action if indeed that takes place? During a church service, through the week, if you're running a Christian school, you know, what is your game plan? Do you have something in place so that it's not going to be a free-for-all, but rather it's going to be, okay, this problem, here's what we do. And it's already set up in advance. You may want to practice it. We have a church out in the suburbs of Philadelphia, and they probably have about 800, 1,000 people in the church. They actually practice evacuations from the sanctuary. To me, that's a little bit extreme. But they do that on a fairly frequent basis, where they just run everybody out of the building in a rehearsal of, in case, you know, they have somebody who's like an armed intruder, like we saw up on the screen earlier. And so, you know, there's a spectrum of things that can be done. The thing is to get started, though, and maybe some of the most basic issues. The shooter, as I said, is kind of the end of the line, if you will, and yet it's there. Vandalism of property. How do you cope with that? One of the ironies for being here this week, I got a call Monday morning at 2 a.m. I had not yet left Philadelphia to come here to the conference. And we have a security system in our church. We have an alarm system. And they called because there was a sensor that was triggered. And I've had false alarms in that previously. And I'm the first guy they call on the list. So I asked the people at the security company, I said, you know, do you have any other detectors that have been triggered? Well, no. And I kind of wrote it off as a false alarm. I got a call from my people after I was on the road coming here. And indeed, we had the very first break-in into our church we have ever had in over 80 years that I know of. It took place at 2 a.m. this past Monday morning. And so then we had to go back now, call the police back in after the fact and so forth, and I wasn't there to handle that, so the deacons had to deal with it. But it's one of those things, okay, do you have a plan? Do you even have an alarm on your church? A couple of weeks ago, another church in our community, apparently this may be a trend that's going on, they broke into that church. They took out all the copper piping. They took out all the piping out of the basement and all that to sell for scrap. The only problem is when you take out piping, it tends to let water flow all over the place. And so you can have significant damage as a result of something like that. The irony is that church has more people living closer to it than people live around our church. And nobody saw anything. So, anyway, those things that we look at, vandalism of property, bomb threats, suspicious packages and containers. If you see any kind, it doesn't have to be a metal container. It could be a box. It could be a trash bag even, because you can put bomb materials inside of a trash bag. It may be anything that is strange and out of place is something that needs to be checked. And that's something that, again, we develop a mindset to look for those things. Health emergencies, I don't know if you people have like an AED in your church or not. They're kind of a mixed blessing in the fact that if you needed it, it's good to have. If on the other hand you don't, though, it is expensive to maintain. It's not just the initial purchase. But because it's a licensed piece of equipment, then you have to pay for renewals and updates and so forth. And so if you're looking into something like that, maybe you want to speak about what the long-term costs are so you know what you're getting into. An AED, everybody know what that is? Or can I use the acronym, or you understand what that is? All right. For people who have heart attacks, what it does is a means to evaluate and regulate heart rhythm until emergency personnel come. So that. Then getting down to service disturbances, I'm down to Roman numeral 2 and F if you're following the outline that is there. People who speak out during the service, and maybe they're challenging the pastor or preacher up front there, they may be just physically abusive with the people that are sitting next to them. It may be just localized within the meeting room where things are going on, and where it's the disturbance maybe just between two or three people. Those are other events. Becoming physically abusive, which often escalates to, and then actual threats directly or indirectly to the worshipers. And then, of course, ultimately, if they're displaying any kind of weapon, not just a gun. Our mindset with all these things seems to gravitate to, you know, the active shooter, to that end of the spectrum. But there are other things that people may well bring and use, that they can use as a weapon, that they can attack the person who's sitting next to them or whatever. And so anybody who displays anything that can be used as a weapon is a potential risk that is there. And so, again, those are things to be look for along the way. Then the questions, G, and this goes back to the matter of developing a plan of how do we, you know, we kind of play the what if, and then, okay, who's going to do what? And this is where the idea of security teams kind of evolves, if you will, because in the recommendation of most insurance companies, and I have to say, you need to talk to your church insurer about how to pursue the things we're talking about here today, because they are going to be the ones who are going to decide whether they're not going to pay for whatever damage is done or any harm that is inflicted. And so your insurer is the ultimate guideline for the subject that we're addressing here, because they're the ones who are going to be financially liable if there's any kind of problem that takes place. And so just as a caveat, if you will. But the thing is, you know, okay, everybody in the church has a cell phone, so is everybody going to dial 911? And there's two sides of that coin. Either everybody's going to dial and you're going to overwhelm the system, or number two, everybody's going to say, well, so-and-so, he's the one who takes care of that, so he'll do that. And then maybe he doesn't know he's supposed to do it, and so then the call doesn't go in, or it doesn't go in quickly enough, or people look at each other and say, who's going to call? And time is going by. The other video I'll be showing at the end of this is called 480 Seconds. And the idea is that in that 6-minute interval that is there, or 8-minute interval rather, there is limited time in what can be done in order to limit the damage that's going to take place. So you don't have a whole lot of time. If you follow the shooting incidents and perhaps you've, you know, looked at how long did it take them to shoot how many people, then you realize that the margin for error, you know, is really serious. It's something that we need to pay very close attention to. Are there other contacts or calls that need to be made as soon as possible? If this involves people in the church, and if there's any kind of harm or whatever that's done or threat that is done, perhaps maybe family members in a children's ministry, maybe parents need to be notified about it as soon as possible. So you want to make sure that they are aware. You do not want to try to hide any of these things. You want to deal with it openly and up front. And you want to do so in a way where you are ahead of the curve when it comes down to that. And then whether or not alerts can be broadcast. And that may be something of if you have the ability to send blanket text messages. And I know for people who have children in Christian schools, and I know a lot of schools, they have the ability to just put out a blanket text message if there's any kind of incident or event that everybody, all the parents need to be notified. But that would take some setting up with the people in your church if you know, intend to do that. That relies on the ability not only to send it, but also that everybody is able to receive it. And there's no guarantee that if you just broadcast that everybody does, unless their phone is prepared and you have the right phone number, you know, all those kinds of details. So that when that goes out, then you have some confidence that all the people who need to be notified will be notified. So you deal with that. Other issues, and I go on here in the bottom of the page, and we've already talked about exits and so forth. That's part of the run. You know, we talked about run, hide, fight. Those are the three things. The, you know, remedy, if you can run, if you can escape without being hurt, then that's the first priority. Get out. And if you go out a door or you go out a window, go out any way that is possible. But again, it requires any way that you are aware of where you are. If you have to stop and think about, you know, okay, where are the exits? If you stop and think about, you know, whether the exits are blocked, then I'll deal with that a little bit later on. Because some of us, you know, we're putting out the trash in church, and so you know, the rear door of the church is, you know, where we put the trash out. So what we do is we line up all the boxes and the bags and everything else. We line it up at the exit that is there, and we could very easily block egress from that exit simply because we're ready to put the trash out. There may be other obstacles that we place. Maybe we're moving equipment back and around, and somehow it ends up blocking a door or even blocking a window for that matter. And so as such then, one of the first things, and again, we're taking some baby steps, if you will, just to go around our building and say, okay, if I had to get out of this room, where would I go? Or if I had to get out of here, how would I get around that obstacle that's blocking me from getting out that exit? Or if I were a stranger in the church and I come in and, hey, I got to get out of here in 5 seconds and I'm not familiar, how well are we marked as to where you can exit from any particular room? And we have requirements by law. We have light emergency lights. We have exit signs that are lit. Maybe you have exit signs that aren't bright and shining. One of the things we did in our church a couple of years ago, I got really tired not only of replacing the bulbs and, you know, the ones that had the old incandescent bulbs in them. I was replacing those things every 6 weeks. And not only was it the matter of getting to replace them, but then it became the matter, I think they were about $8 a bulb. It was beginning to be, you know, kind of expensive. And not everybody pays attention and looks and sees, hey, are all the lights lit on the exit sign? So we converted everything to LED. That was an improvement, but I'll from experience, let me tell you, then the problem is no longer the LED lights themselves and those things. The problem becomes the batteries for them. The batteries don't run out as fast as the incandescent bulbs does, which is good. But on the other side of it, though, the batteries of those things, they will probably, maybe 2 years max is what you'll get out of those. And they're fairly expensive, but in the long haul, it's cheaper than the incandescent bulbs. But again, if you have an exit sign and it's not lit, if you lose your electricity, if you're in the dark and you don't have any idea which direction to go, then what happens? You may create a panic situation. You can kill people just by bringing panic about. You can have a stampede where people will trample other people. And in larger situations with larger numbers of people, people can die just being trampled underfoot because of the press, because people see one way out and they all flock to it. They all follow each other and they go in that herd mentality there, if you will. So then, yes, sir. Sure.
And also the ones in the emergency lighting.
Yes.
Which we have to have in California as well.
Yes.
And I found them on the internet for $6 each, which was considerably cheaper than the price at Home Depot and other outlets around us.
Yeah.
Also, there are conversion kits where you can put LED lights in your, if you bought them years ago like we did, the exit signs, they do make conversion kits to convert them over to LED lights. You don't have to buy a whole new exit sign.
Okay. The only question I would pose with that, though, is whether or not the LEDs function with the same batteries as the incandescent lights do. Okay.
That's another thing that I would suggest. Most of them have a button on them.
Mm-hmm.
It cuts the electricity off and you can see if it's working.
Yes.
Have somebody do that about every 2 months.
Yes.
Just to make sure that that it's still functioning properly and your battery has not run batteries.
Yeah. You can have an emergency light lit, and you can have like the little pilot light lit on it, and you can push the button to test it, and there's no light. It doesn't work. Just the fact that you may, if you have the other lights for hallways, for darkened hallways and so forth, they have a pilot light on them, but the thing is, if you push the button, they may not light up, and if that's the case, and you get a serious battery problem, and you can be deceived by the pilot light that's on there thinking that, hey, all the pilot light says is it's working on the AC side. Okay? not necessarily the battery safe. Your point is, while taking the test them on a regular basis, though, yeah, because of that.
Also, the last time our church was broken into, they actually came in through the roof. And so down through the attic, and they broke into the roof.
In Philadelphia, they take air conditioners off of rooftops. And somebody said, well, how do they get them down? I said, it's simple. They drop them because they don't care if they run or not. They're going to sell them for scrap. I had one church, though, a fellow was robbed twice of rooftop air conditioners. And he couldn't believe it. I said, well, don't you have a cage around them? Well, it's up on the roof. I said, yeah, what's your point? You know, it's... We're living in different times, gentlemen. It's considerably different. Let me continue. Fire extinguishers, because, hey, that's the first line of defense if you have any kind of a fire that erupts there. Are they currently certified? Are they currently tagged? Are they currently inspected? And that's an expense for church. Sometimes it's something we want to kind of not look at too closely. And yet, if you don't have a functioning fire extinguisher, you can have a larger problem. I'll just put it that way. And also, I don't know if you noticed in the video that was shown there, a fire extinguisher is really a good weapon if you need to defend yourself. And they only demonstrated it in using it, you know, as kind of like a cudgel of some sort, you know, and a weapon that way. But, hey, discharge the fire extinguisher in the face of the offender, okay? And when that runs out, then hit them with it, okay? Yeah. It has a twofold purpose, if you will, that it can serve. Security personnel and in the formation of the team. Our church is insured with Brotherhood Mutual. I don't know who you have. This is their guidebook for church security. I forget how many hundred pages, over 200 pages. Costs about $40. And they have a whole program laid out here. The thing is, it's a pretty elaborate program. It's pretty extensive. And it's challenging. Yes? I'm sorry?
What insurance company is that?
Brotherhood Mutual. In Pennsylvania, we have an arrangement amongst PARB churches that we all pool together with Brotherhood Mutual, and PARB benefits from that financially. And if you want to learn more about that, then, you know, we can discuss that at another time. But as I said before, though, your insurer is the one, though, who is the one who is really going to determine whether or not you are doing the right things and doing them sufficiently. And it more or less is something that needs, you know, their approval, although they wouldn't call it that. But the problem is, though, is if you have a problem and you make a claim, then you have an issue, you know, with your insurance company, where they may balk at you know, funding everything that's necessary depending on what the situation is. Going on with security personnel, though, the issue of how do you have people who are available every day? Now, I told you our church has an alarm system. We have a list of people who are called. I'm at the top of the list. There's two or three other people. There are times when if I'm not readily available, they'll call them. And I've had situations where they don't always answer the phone either. So in Philadelphia, you have a problem in that, okay, are you going to call the police for everything? Well, if you start to do that, then they're going to start billing you from the city. Same thing with the fire department. If they get too many false alarms, and you know, you may have an opportunity for one or two that they'll let slide, but beyond that, though, it could become an issue. So you need some discernment that is there. My protocol is if there's more than one sensor is tripped in the alarm system, then send the police. And that failed this past Monday because we had the break-in. Although apparently the reports I've received, I haven't been home since, is that after they broke in and they triggered the alarm, there was a motion detector in the room inside that was tripped. it must have scared them off, because when our people searched the building after the fact and went through, nothing else was disturbed. So I presume that after they smashed the window in and tried to, they may or may have not have gained entry, that they decided it was better to leave because the alarm was sounding outside. So, you know, to that degree, you know, my protocol failed, and yet on the other hand, the alarm system kind of saved us from any further trouble because it scared them off, thankfully. Thank the Lord. But train people so that you have a coordinated plan of action, who does what, as we mentioned before. And then there's a question about how security people are to be identified. In one of the church security programs, and I've participated in a lot of different things. There was a matter where either you made the decision one of two ways. Either you had your security people always identifiable to everybody. And it might be, generally what I saw was that they would use an armband. And so, you know, you always knew who the security person was. That has advantages. It also has disadvantages. All right. That's kind of a trade-off. The advantage is if there's an emergency, people know immediately who to go to. That's the plus side. The negative side, let's say if you had an armed intruder and he sees a guy with the armband, he says, I got to take him out first. And you can make yourself a target. The flip side of that is that there are armbands that are essentially like a rolled up thing on the side of your belt. And they're in a bright orange or in a fluorescent yellow. And if there's an incident where security people need to be identified, they can pull that out, put that over their shoulder and back around, and that extends both front and back, and they can be quickly identified in the situation. So if you're going to have personnel who are prepared to deal with some of the incidents that we've described and some of the other things that may take place, then you have to deal with that question. Are you people going to be identifiable all the time, or is it going to be only when there's an incident? I would like to think, and this is just my own preference, and you're certainly going to make your own choices, but I would think it would be less disturbing to the people if you didn't see a bright, you know, fluorescent, you know, banner on somebody every single time you go into church. I think, you know, somehow there might be some measure of distress to that. The guy who came up, though, with the other invention of the one that rolled up in the belt and in the one program that I participated in, it was something where you could just deploy. It's like they just pulled it out, put it over their shoulder, and it was there. And they could deploy it in 30 seconds or less. And then you had it where it was needed at the time it was needed. Otherwise, it was not seen. It's kind of like, you know, when you carry concealed weapons, all right, I'll draw that analogy, if you will. It's always better, I think, for people to carry concealed than to carry open. In Pennsylvania, you can carry open. It's not really advised, and it's not frequently done. But technically, according to Pennsylvania law anyway, you can carry open. But think about, you know, how that may disturb people, much like that banner, okay, that's, you know, always being seen all the time. And so it's better, you know, to go the other extreme. I've carried concealed for 25 years. In all my years pastoring the church, nobody has ever seen my weapon. But it's always within reach of me. And always has been. But I don't even discuss that with the people in my church. That's just me. Okay? So, anyway. Let me go on. The problem of untrained people. You have trained people, and they know what to do, and so-and-so is going to call 911, this person's going to do this, that person's going to do that, and you have that all prepared. And the thing is to have that kind of thing, that assistance available for all ministries. That could be a challenge in terms of how many people are involved and how many are available through the week, not just on a Sunday or a Wednesday night or any other night when you have an activity. So the numbers that are involved with that are challenging in themselves. And then, of course, the training, other than the preparation, the deciding of the game plan, and then who's going to do what of the game plan and follow all the steps all the way through. But you may have other people, though, who are in your congregation, and they take it upon themselves to do things. That can be counterproductive. That can be a problem. If on the other hand, the people know you have people – who are prepared. You have people who've been trained. You have people who are going to be there for all the activities of the church. Therefore, what you're sending is a message that says, we have somebody who's going to take care of that, all right? What you need to do is just take care of you personally. Run, hide, fight applies, you know, when you're dealing with something that's of serious nature. All right, so then, greeters are the first line of defense. And it may be something where, number one, do we have greeters? And number two, how are they trained? And the perceptions of people who come in. What I like to do, and we do this better in Sunday school than we do it in church, is when somebody comes in who's a stranger, we hand them a card. We say, would you please fill this out? And we hand them a visitor card. Now, if I come into your church and you offer me a visitor card and I say, nah, I don't want to do that. Well, sir, you know, we really like, you know, we want to be able to keep you informed about the activities. No. And you can begin to read the situation, you know, from there. But greeters need to have perhaps some, you know, training in terms of looking at those kinds of things and interpreting them. It may be perfectly harmless. Yes?
Have you ever had to ask someone to leave?
Not yet. I know of other churches, though, where they've had to ask people to leave, and then they also, there are other situations where they had to actually call the police in to have people removed. Because when they were asked nicely, they refused. Okay, there's an example. You can speak to that, Mike, perhaps. Thankfully, I have not yet had that experience, okay? But then again, I never had the church broken in, like I said, for like 85 years. Not of my 85 years. The church is 85 years, if you will, okay? But greeters, you know, the people who first see the stranger come in. And, you know, to take it from there. And the thing is, you know, we don't want to alienate people. We want visitors to come in. It's kind of a, you know, you're torn between to a large degree. Because on the one hand, you want to get them in and, you know, but then again, you know, you're careful. Now, I've had people come into the church and they just get up and walk out. And I just figured that's my preaching. So, you know, I don't fret about that a whole lot. And if they leave, they're not a problem because they're going back out the door again. Yes. Well, this is something else when we talk about doors and windows and those kinds of things. And for the ushers or greeters or security personnel that you have, I'll get into that a little bit later. What doors are open? What doors are accessible? Do you lock doors? Oh, no. No, that's a definite issue that needs to be, you know, dealt with.
We have a trained security person that's in there. They can watch all the exits, all the egresses, and they can, and any person that walks out of here, they would be following them.
No, in fact, in our church, what we've done is we've actually locked off internally areas of our church on Sunday nights. So that whoever comes in only comes in from the front door of the church where they're visible to the ushers at the top of the steps. And if they were to try to go downstairs and try to go down through the basement, access other areas there, first thing they would meet is a locked door internally. Now it's a panic bolt on the other side for exit. But on the front side of it, so to speak, the side towards our foyer, we have a key lock on that. And on Sunday evenings, we don't hesitate to lock that. If people need to get to the back areas of the building on a Sunday night, then someone can come and unlock the door, or we'll take them around and they can go outside and get them in through the other locked door in the back of the building. But the back door of our church is locked between Sunday school and church. So that when we are all in the church sanctuary and there's, you know, hardly anybody in our Sunday school building, we lock that door between services so that they have to come in the front door and be visible to our ushers. Yeah, you want to make sure that you route people coming and going, you know, in ways where they're visible. And you don't want them to have any kind of access. I don't want to get into too many stories. I actually surprised somebody who was hiding in a lady's bathroom. This is almost 20 years ago. That had no windows, so when the light was off, it was total darkness inside. And it was in the front of the church. It wasn't in the back. And it was on a weekday. And I was going into the church just myself. And you ever have that sense that there's somebody else here? You ever get that feeling? And as I opened the door to the ladies' room, this hand came around the door, pulled the door out of my hand, pushed me out of the way, and went out the front door. I had not locked the front door, which in that case was probably a good thing. Because if they had been frustrated getting out of the building, I don't know, you know. But, and that was like a Monday or Tuesday in the week. There was nothing going on in the church. So, you never know. Come back. Church buildings. Let's get on because my time's going to get away here. Presence of combustible materials that are easily accessed by anyone, either inside or outside the building. Could somebody come in and start a fire in your church? Could they start a fire somewhere outside the church that might be of threat? If you have combustible materials outside, then, you know, that's something if somebody wanted to, you know, vandalize your church, if they could use that to start a fire that would do damage to your buildings or even to your vehicles. Okay, if you church bus, church van, those things might also be vulnerable to that kind of thing. Monitoring church access. And I've posed the question, on a typical Sunday, how many outside doors are locked? Which open doors have greeters? Are they monitored in some other way if you don't have greeters? Is it possible for anybody to enter a building sight unseen by anyone inside or outside? And those are, I just throw those out as questions for you to, you know, look at your facility, look at your building, you know, look at it from that kind of a perspective and ask the question. And then if you see an issue that is there, then the question is, okay, how do we change this? How do we remedy this? Because this may pose up. I don't think that any of us probably ever thought about somebody taking our trash and making a fire out of it that's going to be a problem, but it can be. And you can do serious damage in the process. All right. Then going down to nighttime services and after dark. And that gets into a question then of lighting. And then again, how many doors are open for that? Nighttime poses a whole other set of issues. How far can people move around on your campus before they are seen or recognized? Are there places where people can hide in the outside parts of your buildings? If you have like a covered entrance door somewhere, is that sheltered in such a way that people could actually be standing in there, just standing at the door, maybe not being able to gain entry, but can they get there and nobody sees and nobody knows? In Philadelphia, we have the problem where people, you know, if they have weak kidneys or otherwise, you know, may resort to some little corner somewhere in a church property. Okay? Need I say more? All right? You understand what I'm saying? And that's a reality in the city, all right, where people may take advantage of that. Regulating access, key holders, and again, you know, for people whom and then the question is, if they left the church, did they turn in their key? Did you take their code off the security system? And then a question of a video security system. I notice you have a video security here. Looked like it was a four-camera system. It looked like it was mostly exterior?
Yes.
Okay, on the exterior. They're getting cheaper, I'll put it that way. You could probably put in an eight-camera system, just the equipment, not the installation, for about $1,000 or less. The reason I know that is because I'm looking at that prospect now for our church. I haven't pursued it, but I'm just doing the research on it. But the advantage of that is that you have the ability to see places where you can't monitor in person. And so that kind of helps you to consolidate then the views, if you will, of what's going on around your church buildings and campus. The other advantage of that is then also that you can record it. And there are, you know, like terabyte recorders and so forth, you know, that will collect all that kind of information. And that may be of value somewhere down the road, or it may be that you can review things, and maybe there are times when nobody, the church people are at church, but you have other people on your grounds for whatever reason it may be. And there may be people who are on your grounds and doing whatever that you have absolutely no clue about because you're not here when they're here. So the ability to record it has several purposes. Number one, it reveals that maybe there's some other use of your property that you don't approve of, but it's not known to you. Number two is that if there is any kind of an incident, and it may not be something that happened on your church property, it may be something that happened across the street or down the block even to some degree, depending. And in Philadelphia, the police department, when they have a shooting incident, for example, the very first thing that they do, and if it's a residential area, they'll go down, they'll look at all the houses and see which ones have cameras pointed out toward the street. They'll go to those homes and they'll ask for copies of the recordings that are made. And that's actually helped them to solve crimes, and especially the shooting incidents that we have in the city of Philadelphia, because people have home video systems that include cameras that are facing out the front of their home onto the street. And so it's something to consider. If you have somebody who can pull the wire and, you know, and do that, the connecting work of it and everything else, then, you know, those are things you can investigate and look at. But there's a definite benefit, and it's a question of cost. And if you have to have somebody to install it, it'll be much more expensive, I'm sure. But you have somebody who can, you know, connect Cat 5 wire and make connectors. And these days they have what they call PoE systems, power over Ethernet. And what they do is they, instead of running a power line and a signal line, they run the power over the signal line. And so then that cuts your wiring costs way down as a result of that. My only question I haven't answered in that is, how far can you go before the loss of power over distance?
About
500
feet.
That's not.
It may be greater than that, but ours run at least 500 feet, and we have no loss of the quality of the video or anything.
Thank you. You've answered my question. I've been asking all around, and people had no idea.
You know what our church building looks like.
Yeah.
We have cameras on the front. We have eight cameras, and we're thinking of putting another eight in the nursery. Thing. We have eight cameras, and we have our monitor and all, and the recording system in the front, in the office. And we run all the way from there, all the way back to the back of the property where we have the Sunday school rooms that are out away from the main building. One of the men in our church just went out and bought, because it doesn't come with that long, it only comes with 200 feet.
Yeah.
And I said, well, can we join them together? He said, forget it.
No.
And he went out and he bought
a roll.
A roll.
Yeah.
A huge thing.
Yeah. 500 or 1,000 feet of Cat 5.
Right. It's not Cat 5.
Okay.
This is the PoE.
Yeah. Okay.
And let me suggest that you install your cameras up high enough to where the guy that's wanting to do damage can't get to them easily.
Yeah, vandalism of the cameras is a risk. So you need to really put them in a place where they're not readily accessible. Although I have to be honest and say that doesn't guarantee it. Because if somebody's going to shoot the camera, you know, distance no longer is a question. Yes, that's true. All right, let me go on.
Another thing.
Yes.
Build a cage that you put your recording equipment into that they cannot easily get to it. It gives the police time to get there before they've taken away the recording equipment.
Okay. Or at least hide it so that it's hard to find. Bringing in outside help. I need to move on. These days, police departments are running programs, all kinds of things, but police and fire departments are generally, there's no charge. They'll come in, they'll look at your situation. If they look at your fire alarms in the fire department and extinguishers and all that kind of stuff, if the police come in and they evaluate as to whether or not you have egress ability that's fast enough for people to get out of the situation, or they'll ask some of the same questions that I posed here about what doors are locked, what doors are open, can somebody come in and be unseen in any area of your buildings or your property, and you know, all those things, and they will come in and they will do that just as a service. More and more police departments are developing training programs because they recognize the issue. Well, yeah, it helps them, you know, and so I've done several, taken several different programs, different police departments, and the level that they've come to recently is really good. Questions of armed security personnel. I want to touch on that because that was something that we started with here, and I'm coming full circle. And it's a question between, first of all, whether it's going to be your security personnel or church members. I have at least two other members of my church who carry in church. I'm not real happy about that because their level of training is significantly less than mine anyway. In fact, one of them is probably totally untrained, okay, not even military experience. But the thing is, though, if you're going to, that's a decision you're going to have to make, and it's better if you have personnel and they are trained. One of the things I listed there, I don't know if you were aware of this, NRA, which I've been a member for a long, long time, now has offered carry insurance. And if you sign up for that, and there's obviously a cost for it. But the point being, though, if you ever, and this is not just for church, this is just in general, okay? If for any reason you carry a concealed weapon and you have to use it, you need some legal help, you need somebody who's going to stand together with you and help you through that experience and accountability. And NRA offers that, and I have an ID card that I carry on me all the time in my wallet, and it's for that purpose. If for any reason I should have to draw a weapon and use it, what the advice is, call them first. You know, don't talk to anybody until you call them, and there are different levels of support that they have. If you investigate that, you'll see the details of it, but that's something that I think is worth considering. And then, yes, sir. Okay. You know what's USCCA? Ed, why don't you, so they know who to contact.
U.S. Concealed Carry Association. Tim Schmidt is the guy that started.
Yes. Okay, so there are things there to help, is the point, all right? And if you carry it concealed, and if you're ever going to have to use it, you're going to wish you had it if you don't. Because you can be in more trouble for yourself just because you drew your weapon and had to use it. The other last thing is consideration of less than lethal weapons. And I don't have one recommendation one way or the other as far as those are concerned. Law enforcement tries to use them more, but let's face it, if you have an armed intruder, you're not going to have the opportunity, okay, to deal with, you know, with a less than lethal. Is the gentleman upstairs yet? Up in the crow's nest, as they call it. Can you run my last video, please? And if you have any other questions, we can talk about this over lunch or whatever. I hope this has been somewhat helpful, or at least raised some questions for you to think about.
480 seconds.
What?
480 seconds. The average length of an active shooter incident.
8 minutes. Good to know.
Why don't you start over there and I'll look this side and see.
Okay.
I'm Detective Lambert with the police department. We're just trying to figure out what happened here this morning. Were you in the building during the incident?
Yeah, I was there.
And your name?
Terrence. Terrence Groves.
Mr. Groves, did you happen to see the shooter?
No. I mean, I heard someone say that it could have been a vendor or something, but nobody knows for sure.
So tell me what happened.
I'm just sitting at my desk, and I heard what I thought sounded like gunshots, followed by a lot of screaming. And it sounded like it was all coming from a different part of the office. So I just I left my briefcase there, and I just got out of there off the floor as soon as I could. And I was trying to lead others, but if they paused and if they hesitated, I didn't stop for them at all. So when I finally got outside to safety, I called 911.
Yeah, well, getting out while you could, leaving your stuff behind, not slowing down for anyone who hesitated. Smart. Thank you, Mr. Groves. If you can think of anything else, please give me a call.
Thanks. I will.
Ma'am? ¿Está bien?
No, es que mi amiga la dejé allá adentro. Estaba allí, Nicole.
Respire profundo. Que vamos a resolver esto juntos. ¿Cómo se llama usted?
Officer, it's okay to speak English. It's just that when I get upset, I start talking in Spanish. My name is Lydia. Lydia Sanchez.
Okay, Lydia. Detective Diaz with the police department. Why don't you tell me what happened in the building a little earlier?
I remember hearing what sounded like gunshots and screaming from down the hall, and it was getting closer, so I tried to get out of there as fast as I could. And on my way out, I saw my friend Nicole on the ground, holding onto her desk. And she was scared to death, and I begged and I pleaded for her to leave, but she wouldn't budge, so I left.
Lydia! Lydia!
And when I got outside, I saw a group of employees. They were going to enter the building, and I remember stopping them and telling them what was happening. So we all left to a safe location and waited for the police to arrive.
So you never saw the shooter?
No. But someone told me that it might have been one of the janitors who worked for an outside company.
Lydia, what you did was very brave. You may very well have saved those people's lives.
Yeah, but what about Nicole?
Yes, Lydia, you were just a part of an active shooter incident. Okay, in those situations, it's all about putting you and your own safety first. You made a choice, Nicole made a choice. Putting your own life at risk when you already have a safe way out of the building is not something you want to do. What's Nicole's last name?
Ramos.
Nicole Ramos. We'll get that information to you, okay?
We're going to dismiss. I think they're ready to serve us lunch. Pastor, we're good that way. Sir, yep. Okay. All right. I hope, as I said, I hope this is helpful, or at least it has stimulated some thinking on the subject. We do have a duty to protect our people, protect our ministry, and we want to protect the church's reputation. Because that's also at risk with all these things. Let's just pray for as we finish here. Heavenly Father, we know that except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. We look to you first and foremost. But Lord, you've granted us wisdom, and I pray that we might use that wisdom that you provide. And Lord, help us to watch over our flock, to keep the flock safe, and to be able to also pursue our ministries actively unhindered by concerns or worries about these things, because we've taken steps to provide for it. We just thank you for the lunch that's being served. We ask your blessing upon that now. In Jesus' name, amen.